Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hey everyone, Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's terrific, as always, to have your company for another episode of the show. Now imagine you're going to work. Imagine you're a police officer and you're part of an elite group that deals with all sorts of nasty things. And on this particular day, you get shot 14 times. You're going into a situation and it changes rapidly. Things turn for the worse very, very rapidly, resulting in you lying on the ground with severed arteries, shrapnel wounds, bullet wounds, and you're fighting for your life. Well, that's exactly the situation my guest endured today. Derek McManus is a former police officer, former member of the STAR team, and he's really passionate about talking about human durability. And while we all understand and value resilience, and we certainly want to emphasize the importance of that, we want to pair that with durability, and that's the ability to perform under pressure, perform in a sustained way under pressure. And Derek's going to unpack what that looks like using his own experience of being shot, you know, 14 times in this particular encounter, not to mention the other scenarios he discusses in this podcast as well. So as always, have a pen and paper handy because this is a rich vein, it's a rich topic, and I know that for everyone in business and indeed everyone in life, there are going to be things that you're going to go through that you're going to need to just be able to work through. Yes, of course, from a resilience point of view, you'll be able to bounce back and all that sort of stuff, but there's going to be a time where you're going to need to bring out that bit of fight and to grit your teeth and get through something. And in this conversation today, Derek unpacks it and shares some really practical strategies about how to overcome whatever it is you're dealing with. If you want to find out more about Derek's stuff, please go across to his website, which is called humandurability.com.au. There's a whole bunch of resources there. I'd encourage you to check them out. Here's Derek McManus. Derek, thanks so much for joining us here at the Savvy Dentist Podcast. How's things in your world today?
Busy. Today in particular is absolutely flat out busy. Which is actually the way I enjoy living life. I like to have things to do. So today's ticking a few boxes for me.
Excellent. Well, same with me, actually. I have this theory that, you know, bite off as much as you can and chew like crazy and go for it. Derek, you've got a really interesting story. And obviously, you know, you're very well known for being at the center of a major siege in South Australia some years ago now. You're part of the STAR group in the police force, the Special Tasks and Rescue Group, if I've got that acronym correct. And I'm just curious to ask how you found your way into a career like that. And I'm curious to ask, what did you learn being part of that mob? That sounds like a pretty high action, high energy kind of job.
Yeah, thank you. It was a sensational job. How I found my pathway into that is somewhat funny, somewhat embarrassing. When I was growing up, my brother, 2 years older than me, was my absolute hero. Anything my brother wanted to do, Derek had to be involved in. And at one stage, my brother said, oh, I want to become a police officer. And Derek has gone, yep, I want to become a police officer too. And everybody around us, family, friends, you only want to do that because Brian wants to do it. No, 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 I want to do it myself. My brother changed his mind and became a butcher.
Okay.
Derek now couldn't change his mind because that would prove everybody else right. So I found my way into the police department because of my brother's interest, but it was a great job and I enjoyed it, but I was never a passionate police officer who lived, breathed, ate, read, dreamt policing, didn't go on holidays and visit other police departments, but I was passionate about doing a good job at whatever I did. But after a little while, policing became boring to me.
Yep.
It didn't give me the challenges, and I was looking around to try and find another job, and this shows you how old I was. I was looking through the newspaper and reading the advertisements. Yeah, well, there was no Seek in my day.
I remember those days.
And somebody said to me, why don't you join STAR Group? And, you know, I went, I can't think of anything else to do at the moment. That sounds like it will be interesting, and it ticked a lot of boxes for me. It was outdoors, it was active, it was physical challenges, and it was about solving problems and taking on challenges. And I just gone, you know, that sounds like it would be interesting, and it sounds like it would be fun. But I didn't go in with the blinkers on. I went in knowing that this was going to be a place where I had more risk of being shot and injured. I had more risk of being shot and killed. That was something that had already happened in my policing career.
Oh, wow.
In the past, that I'd been in situations where somebody had tried to shoot my partner. We got into a wrestling match, and the only thing that stopped the weapon going off is that it was broken. It had to be cocked.
Yeah.
And so when we were wrestling and the guy's girlfriend cocked the gun, I put my thumb between the hammer and the gun to hold the hammer back so it wouldn't fire. So I didn't go in blinkered thinking, oh, this is just going to be good fun. I knew what I was taking on. I talk about that as I knew that I was going into a risky situation, but I wasn't risk-taking, I was risk-managing, taking a very cognizant look at what they were, what my skills were to manage it and what resources I had around me. But I certainly went in there and absolutely loved it. You know, we had all the boys' toys you could ever imagine. We had planes, we had helicopters, we had boats, we had weaponry, we had camping, we had abseiling, we had all the adrenaline stuff that you really enjoy. My mother had a different opinion of all those things,
I'm sure she did.
But I loved it. And it was the challenging situations causing me to lift my performance to the next level that I really, really enjoyed.
That sounds like, you know, I'm just going back to that wrestling match and sticking your thumb between the hammer and and whatnot. To me, that sounds absolutely terrifying. And I'm thinking about being in that situation and literally having to, you know, fight for your life. How do you maintain control of your emotions in that scenario? Or is it just that your training kicks over and you kind of do what you need to do to get through that situation? Was there an emotional response during that, after that? And again, you know, if someone's trying to shoot you and your partner, that's a really serious day at the office. How do you process that after the fact?
We need to be following our passion to start off with. There's no way in the world you want to become a star group officer. You're very comfortable with dentistry, right? But there's no way in the world I want to become a dentist. I would be so uncomfortable in that environment. It would send me crazy. So we've all got to have our passion. We need passionate dentists, those ones who want to get right into the nitty-gritty and do the best job in there. We need people who need to be good starries. We need to be great accountants. We need good teachers. And if you're following your passion, you cognizantly take on the risks that are associated with it. Many risks associated with dentistry, many risks associated with Star Group. And this becomes about risk tolerance. Where does your risk tolerance sit? And where does your understanding of your capacity to handle it physically, mentally, and emotionally? And emotionally is one of the most important ones. And that's what you're referring to there. When you go through a situation like that, how do you process it? If this is something that you have anticipated could happen, and then, as I have done, said to myself, if I get into that situation, what can I expect of my mind? What can I expect of my body? What can I expect of my response? How have I managed these sorts of situations in the past? What have I done well? What have I done badly? And how can I improve that in the future? And have open, honest, confronting conversations with ourselves about the reality so that we don't set ourselves up for failure. Realistically, if I get into that situation again, can I expect myself to be overwhelmed? Or do I want to go into that situation, take on that risk, and perform at a better level? And what would that look like? And these are the processes that I went through initially subconsciously. I didn't realize I was doing it. And it's not until I have conversations like these after the big incident that we're going to talk about, which is me being shot 14 times. And once I was having conversations with people about those, I started reflecting on how did I come to being so comfortable with those situations that I can talk about them, analyze them, be open to people telling me that you are an idiot doing that and going, I can appreciate your perspective, but from my perspective, I just loved that job and I wanted to perform well. I'm not the only one that does these things. Our paramedics, our nurses, our other police officers, our military, our fireys, they all put their lives on the line, cognizant of the fact that it could cost them their lives. Some do it proactively and take control of what that might look like. Some just go into the job going, oh, it sounds like it'd be a nice job and I hope it never happens to me. And if you go in saying, I hope it never happens to me, when it does happen to you, it's more likely to overwhelm you and cause you emotional stress and anxieties.
Yeah. I read in my research that you trained with the SAS for a while. What are the raw ingredients that you're looking for either an SAS officer or SAS soldier and or a STAR as well? Because I imagine there's some parallels and some similarities. And can some of those attributes be learned or are they innate?
I believe they can definitely be learnt. There are people who do not have the natural attributes initially, but I think everybody has them innately, but just not willing to absolutely access them because they don't have that belief, I could do what you could do. But I believe they're there, and if they are nurtured properly and you're following the passion you want to,
yes,
then you can step up.
Okay.
Everybody looks at the SAS and STAR Group, and they are very closely aligned. We do very similar jobs. They are much higher trained, much higher skilled than what we are, but the jobs are very, very similar. Both deal with counterterrorism, both deal with high-risk situations, weaponry, and armed defenders. But everybody looks at STAR Group and SAS, and they go, my God, those guys are fit, and if you're fit, you will be able to get into that job. In STAR Group, there are 16 criteria for selection.
Mm.
One of them is fitness.
Wow.
And we've had people that have failed the fitness aspect but had such good leadership, decision-making, ingenuity, initiative, leadership, as well as followship. And the other 15 criteria that they go, we can build the fitness. That's no problems at all. We can work on that. The natural leadership is harder to build.
Mm.
The natural decision-making under pressure is harder to build. And part of the selection course is they wear you out, absolutely exhaust you, so you can't do the higher level thinking.
Mm.
You are just down to baseline and, I don't have the energy to think this through. I'm just going to do what I think is best. And that's what they're looking for. What do you think is best when you're under pressure? And is that in line with high rates of safety, high rates of success? Still staying cognizant enough to analyze a situation to a depth where you can make better decisions than just exhausted.
Okay, so I'll come back to how some of those things can be learned in a minute because I think that there's some real value in exploring that. But let's go to May 1994. Can you tell us what happened on that day?
So there was a guy who had been in court for 197 counts of fraud.
Oh, wow.
He had made threats 197 counts of fraud, not something you normally associate with high potential violence.
No.
But I'd been involved in two jobs with this guy previously. He's never been charged or found guilty with any acts of violence, but he has made threats.
Right.
And these threats are to intimidate people and to proclaim him as the person in charge. And one of those threats he made was when police and other police detectives were investigating the frauds initially, they said, we're going to come to your house to have a chat. And he said, any cop who comes to my house is going to get shot. So he had made that threat. And once you make threats like that, they are taken seriously.
Yeah.
And he went on to the high risk, high potential of violent offender list. And so STAR Group were involved in it. And certainly on the day that we went to arrest him for these 197 counts of fraud, which he failed to turn up in court to answer the charges.
Mm.
So courts issued a warrant to arrest him and bring him into court. We went out there to arrest him for it, knowing that he was a potential high-risk offender. We knocked on the door. He didn't answer. We had a sniper sitting in the bush. We knew he was inside. We knocked again, called again. He didn't answer. I moved down the side of the house to look at a secondary entry point that may be more efficient, effective and safer to go through that entry point. And as I got to within about 2 feet of a sliding door, glass sliding door, he started to shoot and I was his target. He was using a Chinese military assault rifle, same weapon the Chinese use when they go to war. Same bullets fired by the Chinese when they go to war. I can see a question.
Yeah, I'm thinking, how does, not that I want to go and purchase one, but I would have thought that that's how do you get hold of that stuff? I mean, that's obviously the black market sort of stuff, but.
No. And it's putting it into perspective. I mean, these days, yes, but this is in 1994.
Before
Port Arthur. 1996. Gun buyback, 1997.
Yeah.
Perfectly legal to own these weapons.
Wow.
And during the siege, there were 2,000 rounds of ammunition fired.
Yeah.
He had another 3,000 rounds in the roof of his house.
Gosh.
So back in those days, it was perfectly legal. But this is one of the reasons we've changed the legislation to make Australia a safer place. And I believe it is working well for us. So he started shooting. I was a target. He fired 18 times in less than 5 seconds. And we've tried to replicate that with that very weapon. Nobody can fire that weapon that fast. So one, it was well practiced, but two, he was probably high on adrenaline. Mm. And firing that fast, 18 times in less than 5 seconds, and hit me 14 times with either bullets or shrapnel. Okay, now everybody says, and I say I was shot 14 times because that's just a nice, easy phrase, but it was bullets and shrapnel.
Yeah.
And I fired back, and when I fired back, he stopped. I was then managing some major, massive injuries and bleeding profusely.
Yeah.
Two severed arteries, one severed radial artery in my left forearm and a ulnar artery in my right wrist. And then I was lying on the ground conscious for 3 hours before assistance could get to me to extract me from that situation.
So, okay, there's a lot to unpack here, Derek.
There is.
He's fired 18 times in 5 seconds, 14 either rounds or pieces of shrapnel have hit you in different ways, shapes and forms. You've got a couple of severed arteries. Presumably you're lying on the ground in all manner of pain, especially if you're conscious as well. Lying there for 3 hours and you're hearing if there's 2,000 extra, I presume they were the first rounds that were fired in the exchange, right? Is that
correct? Yes.
So that
only his rounds, yes.
Yeah. So that means there's another 2,000 rounds have been fired while you're still lying there. And presumably some of those rounds are whizzing past you. Maybe they're in different directions.
Correct, yep.
What are you thinking? What are you feeling? I mean, obviously you think I've just got to stay safe and get through this. I understand the self-preservation thing.
Yep.
But are you thinking, like, this went south fast or like, you're like, holy crap, you know, like seriously.
That is exactly what I thought. And to a large degree, this went south very quickly is exactly what I thought. But I'd also, 5 years prior to the shooting, when I joined Star Group, I sat down with my wife at that time and had what I call an open, honest, confronting conversation about reality.
Yeah.
And that's confronting done with care, compassion, concern for everybody involved.
Sure.
And done particularly with compassion. But the conversation was, I'm going into Star Group. The reality is in that environment, I may be shot and injured. I may be shot and killed. Now, that's something that everybody goes, yeah, well, you would expect that and you would have those conversations.
Yeah, but that's not one you want to have with your spouse or be on the end of either. That's a tough conversation, Derek.
It is a very tough conversation, confronting, but it's got to be open and honest. And I believe it's a conversation we have to have because everybody's aware that it might happen, not just to Star Group, to any police officer, to fireys, to AMBOs. We go into situations where we know that is going to be challenging physically, mentally, and emotionally. But the conversation I had with her was so that she was very consciously aware of what those risks were.
Yeah.
And part of the conversation was about what's going to happen to me, but more the conversation was for her to accept, if I die, what will her life look like?
Yes.
Because it's not just the person who's in the situation. The impact is on those other people as well. So I wanted to make sure that she was well aware that if I die, she's going to have a very different life to a married life with Derek. And so, you know, we had conversations and this is honestly how the conversations went. It wasn't about me saying, I want you to do this. It was about whatever you choose to do, I will support.
Mm.
I don't want you to go through life going, what would Derek want? Would he have wanted me to stay single? Would he have been accepting of me getting married and somebody else looking after his children? I wanted her to make sure that whatever she chose, I would support it. And I actually threw three options to her. One was you could choose to stay single and look after the children, then have relationships after that if you choose to. I support that. You could get married. Have somebody else look after, just make sure that I look after my children well, blah, blah, blah. The third option that I literally threw to her was, you know, that one, number two, and then the other option is you could just build a shrine in the corner and worship me every day if you wanted to. Now, that conversation wasn't all that popular, or that suggestion, but it broke the tension of that confronting, overwhelming conversation, because she's going, oh, my gosh, oh, Derek, just shut up. Get serious. So it broke the tension and allowed us to continue the conversation on a serious note. Right. I then had a conversation with myself. If I get shot, what can I expect of my mind? What can I expect of my body? What have I done in the past, including that situation where I had to stick my thumb in the gun? I had another incident 3 weeks after sticking my thumb in the gun, which I had to make a decision to shoot or not shoot. I had an incident earlier in my career where I had to shoot or not shoot. And there's lots of other decision-making things that I've done in my career and in my life. And I had to say to myself, what did I do well? What did I do badly? What can I improve upon? If I get shot, what can I realistically expect of myself? How did I stay so calm in that situation? And how do I bring that skill forward to this situation? And that having some idea of what we're going to deal with, some idea of how it's going to affect us, and then some idea of how we'll be able to handle that gives us an ability to get on the front foot and start taking action rather than going, oh my gosh, I knew this was going, but I have possibly going to happen, but I have no idea what I'm going to do with it. You're then starting to go into procrastination mode. But it is simply some idea of what's going to happen, some idea of how it might affect us, and some idea of how we might handle that allows us to move forward. The bigger the challenge, the bigger the risk, the more depth you want to go into in those conversations. And so when I looked at the possibility of getting shot, I knew there were four things that I needed to do. One was control panic. And this applies to anybody, anywhere in business, life, students, whatever it might be. The first one is control panic. Don't let panic take control of the situation. The easiest way to do that is to break the tension with some lightheartedness or some other methodology, including proper planning. The second one, I needed to control shock. It was the acceptance that when we go through any physical or psychological challenge, our body goes into fight and flight response. How do I manage that? How do I bring my body back to homeostasis, for want of a better term, where my blood flow is normal and my prefrontal cortex is being fed with enough blood to get into the higher level thinking, the problem solving and the creativity that it's going to take for me to get through this situation. The third one I needed to do was slow down my heart rate, and I needed to slow down my breathing because I knew that if I could do those four things, it would slow down my rate of bleeding and I would survive. Now, I didn't anticipate I was going to get shot 14 times. I thought if I get shot, and typically it was once, but everything was still applicable to that situation. And that forethought, forewarned, forearmed is the cliche statement, but that forethought prepared me so that when it did happen, there's no doubt about it, my emotions went high. Oh, my God, this is actually happening to me. Our emotions and our rational thinking sit on an even plane. When everything's going the way we want, we can be funny, we can be creative, we can debate, we can analyze. But as soon as things start going out of control, our emotions go up, our rational thinking goes down to fight and flight and panic mode. And it was about me having said, if it gets to this situation, what do I do to bring the emotion back down and the rational thinking back up? With no expectation that they would become perfect, but the closer we can get them, the better decisions we can make. So believe it or not, at the time that I got shot, yes, my emotions went absolutely massive. My rational thinking went low and I had some crazy thoughts while I was falling to the ground. But once I was on the ground, he was still shooting. Oh, something else I'll pick up on is the assumption that obviously you're in massive pain. I wasn't actually in massive pain, which surprises me as much as it surprises anybody else.
Adrenaline.
For me, it felt like somebody had punched me in the stomach and somebody had given me a dead leg. You know, somebody had kneed me in the thigh and, you know, you're walking along with that bruising. But when I initially got shot, I didn't feel a thing. And even when I was lying on my back and two bullets hit my left thigh, time slowed down and these two bullets seemed to take about 30 seconds to hit me, have their effect and time to move on. And I knew that I needed to fire back. But because I'd prepared myself so well beforehand, I knew how to bring the emotion back down and the rational thinking up, and I accepted. I knew there was a possibility of me being shot. I am now being shot. I need to respond in the way that I want to respond. And so I lined up to start firing back. I couldn't see him inside the house. It was dark. Sun was behind me, so it was like a mirror on the door. And I just fired in the direction of where I could hear the sound of gunfire. And as I lined up to fire back, I realized I was firing back along the length of my body. And at the other end of my body are my feet. And when you're lying on your back, your feet are pointing up in the air.
Mm.
And I knew I needed to get up and just shoot over the top of my feet. But I've got weaponry, I've got equipment, I've got a flak vest on, which is very, very heavy.
Yep.
And as I've lifted my upper body up, my feet have come up to counterbalance. And the thought that I ran through my mind was, I better not shoot myself in the foot because the guys at work will give me shit for the rest of my life. Just imagine you get shot 14 times and then you shoot yourself as well.
Yeah, you could have used your feet as a pair of sights, you know, just like.
And you know something? That's what people have said. Instead of getting up above them, why didn't you separate them? And I've gone, damn, that would have been such a good idea.
Well, only for the fact that you've been shot in the thigh, probably not as easy to move as one might think.
No.
So let me ask a question. While you're on the ground, once you'd fallen to the ground, did you receive any other wounds after that directly?
No. He hit me 14 times in that 5 seconds. I then rolled out of the way. He stopped shooting and I rolled out of the way. I managed to get to my feet despite massive injuries to my legs, including my Achilles tendon, which had been 80% of it torn out.
Oh, wow.
And eventually I collapsed back to the ground, rolled onto my back and stayed on the ground for about 3 hours. Now, what ran through my mind was, while I'm lying here, I'm basically defenseless, right? I cannot do anything. I can't move. I've got my pistol in my hand and I'm ready to shoot. But if you watch the video, you'll hear me calling out, I'm hit, I'm hit. My mates acknowledge that. I can't hear them, but they acknowledge we've heard Derek's hit. But I also know that the offenders heard that as well.
Yeah.
Now, I've gone round the corner and before I've collapsed to the ground, I've leant against a wall and I've called out to my mates again, I'm hit, I'm hurt, I need help. Now, I wanted them to hear it. I was well aware that the offender has heard it as well. So when I collapsed onto the ground and I was basically helpless, my biggest concern was, well, obviously my health and my blood and all those sort of things were a concern. But the biggest concern was the fact that he may come out and try and shoot me again.
Yeah.
So on the ground, I accessed the prefrontal cortex and got creative, and I called out, I'm hit, I'm hurt, but I can still shoot. Now, this was just wanting to play with his psychology, wanting him to be worried if he comes out, he's going to be threatened because I can still shoot.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he heard it, but whether he heard it or not, it made me feel better.
Yeah.
That I'd done something consciously to influence that situation.
So this is something I want to talk about, is agency in these circumstances. You know, you kept a bit of your own personal agency in that, yes, you've been incapacitated, but you're still having an impact on the situation in a positive sense. And I want to talk about that in the context of just a broader scenario for a moment for people that no doubt won't experience what you've experienced. But when you're feeling like you're powerless, you're feeling like you're under attack, so to speak, from whatever it is in the world, how do you maintain a sense of agency, a sense of control, or a sense of I've still got a bit of fight in me and I'm not ready to roll over just yet? I wonder if we could talk about summoning that inner, I don't know what to call it, but my dad would call it the inner mongrel.
Yeah.
I'm not done.
Getting the dog in the fight and staying there.
Too right, yeah.
So, again, this goes back to doing what you're passionate about. And if you're doing something that you are passionate about, you'll take a deeper look at all the intricacies that's involved in this situation and want to be the highest performer. I also talk about taking responsibility on 4 different levels. And so when we want to achieve something, we'll be given several different options as to how we might achieve it. And before we even make any choice about what we're going to do, I say we've got to take responsibility on 4 different levels. We've got to take responsibility for the choice that we finally make. We've got to take responsibility for the actions that come from that, right? And those actions could be good or bad by perception by other people. You've got to take responsibility for how they might be perceived, but more importantly, how they're important to you. Got to take responsibility for consequence, and consequence is something that I can delve into a lot deeper. But the next one is to talk about taking responsibility for what the future looks like after that consequence, whether it be positive or negative. And I believe that in doing that, and I didn't do this so much consciously at the time, it was something I did innately. And I look back and I've thought to myself, okay, that was the process I went through. So when I had that conversation with my wife about what her life might look like, I also said to her, if I get shot, I would need you to know right now, death is a reality. And for me, anything better than death is going to be a bonus. And so long as I'm able to interact with my children, even if I do that from a wheelchair, I will find a way to make that interesting, make that acceptable. So long as, bottom line, anything better than death is a bonus, so long as I'm able to interact with my children. And I think that gave me the ability to say, what are those challenges really and how might I handle it physically, mentally, emotionally? But also I talk about five drivers for success and retaining a sense of optimism. Mm. And that is, optimism is not about saying there's a perfect situation and I want to be able to get back to that. Mm. It's about anywhere better than where I am now gives you a sense of optimism. It doesn't have to be as bad as where I am now. Anything better than this is my sense of optimism. Then you've got to believe in your ability to influence the situation. Mm. And that's where I was. I was retaining this sense of optimism. Anything better than death is a bonus, even if I spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair, so long as I'm able to get back to my kids. What do I need to do to make that happen? How can I influence that situation? And I'd thought through those processes before about control panic, control shock, breathing, and heart rate. And understanding that this was possibly going to be a challenge and I had certain skills that I could implement, and also having done the STAR Group course and having that insight into my ingenuity, my initiative, my creativity in situations gave me the confidence that I may be able to come up with something even in the moment. I've done a lot of pre-planning, but there's an old military saying that there is no plan that will survive encounter with the enemy, because those buggers always change something up. So it was about saying, I've got a plan to be able to manage this, but I'm also adaptable to the situation and I can get creative in the moment. The one thing that kept me going throughout the whole thing was just being able to get back to my kids and interact with them. And I say that thinking about my kids for the entire 3 hours I was out there gave me the focus and the determination to fight to live. And an insight that I don't always give people. As they were sliding me into the back of the ambulance, I was passing in and out of consciousness. My head was right up next to a female nurse above me who was tending me. And I pushed my oxygen my oxygen mask off, and I had a conversation with her. And I said, I need you to let my children know that if I don't get through this, if I don't survive, so the reality that I may die was very, very real to me, but I need you to tell my children, if I die, if I don't get through this, they are the people who kept me going to this point. Thinking of them has kept me alive. And then the oxygen mask came back on and I passed out and woke up in intensive care unit.
Yeah, there's a lot in that too.
I'm sorry.
No.
Would you like to do another episode?
Time? No. I think it's like five episodes right here, Derek. I can't move on without asking how your kids responded to that.
My children. I had two stepchildren at the time. They were about 15 and 17, and two children to our marriage, two biological children to myself, and they were 2 and 4. Mm. And I had had conversations with my wife and my older children about the fact that this may happen to me. And my stepdaughter, Rachel, had actually challenged me on a couple of occasions. You know, the typical 16, 17-year-old young girl who wants to challenge the parent, what would you do if you got shot? You know, and it was basically that language, that attitude. And I was able to articulate at that time, my focus is going to be on controlling panic, controlling shock, slowing down my heart rate, slowing down my breathing so that I can survive and I can think creatively and not lose control of the whole situation. And when I did get shot and I was lying on the ground, Rachel was able to articulate that to the rest of the family and to the police who had come to look after my family. And that gave them some solace.
So sorry to interrupt. So while this siege is going on, you're lying on the ground, presumably the police support network had gone around your house to tell your family what was happening.
Correct.
While it's live and in action.
Yep.
Okay.
And just picking up on that, one of my mates in STAR Group, this is the absolute best situation any STAR Group officer could ask for. This is what we train for, massive siege, massive involvement. Everybody wants to be there. One of my mates, Anthony Fioravanti, He gave up the opportunity to go to that siege to come to my house and look after my family.
Wow.
That was a massive sacrifice on his part and talks a lot about the person he is, where he places importance. Is it work? Is it enjoyment? Mm. Or is it looking after people?
You have this conversation with your wife, with your kids, 5 years earlier about, you know, this is the reality of the situation. This could happen. This could happen. This could happen. They don't have the same training as you. They don't have the same experience as you. They don't have the same context for what's going on around them. And how did they cope with that? Because to hear that conversation, and I know you had an open and honest and confronting conversation.
But the impact is a very different thing.
Yeah, but it's still a hypothetical at that point, right? And then the reality occurs. And I want to ask you how they coped with that, because seeing your husband or your father or, you know, a loved one in that circumstance would be absolutely distressing.
My wife has a religious following. I'm not religious myself, but she said that when she was told I was shot, initially it was a massive shock, but then she said she had a warm feeling over her, and she said that that was God telling her things were going to be all right.
Okay.
Lots of impressions around that. My elder children were impacted greatly, but quite positive about it as well. Obviously panic at the time and worried about whether I will survive, won't I? When the police first got to them, they were actually told, Derek's been shot. We haven't heard from him for 2 hours. It doesn't look good.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that was a context that they were dealing with. So there was certainly overwhelm at that stage. But obviously the first interactions I had with them was when I was in hospital, and I was in a very positive state. Yes, I was in massive pain, but my mental attitude, again, goes back to anything better than death is going to be a bonus. And so that was my approach. That was my attitude. I guess it took them a little while to get around it, but they also got the fact that, yes, Derek's alive. We are going to make the best of life. My two younger children, the 2- and 4-year-old, after about 2 or 3 days in intensive care unit, I said, how are Ash and Josh handling this? And Rosemary said, well, we haven't told them yet.
Okay.
And I've gone, what? How can you not have told them what's happened to Daddy? Yeah. And not at the high level, but just on a level, you know, Daddy's been injured, Daddy's in hospital, whatever it might be. And so I insisted that they bring the children in to see me, and they're made aware. The worst situation I could possibly think of is they were sent to somebody else's house while Mum was in hospital visiting me, or they went to school, kindergarten, and somebody else mentioned, oh, you're the kids whose dad got shot.
So,
and they go,
what?
More impact. So I insisted.
Let's just assume the roles were reversed for a second and something terrible had happened to a loved one of yours, and you're now in the situation where you really can't do much. How would you respond to that? Because I think responding and going, okay, if I die, I die. I kind of understand that self-containment kind of exercise.
Yeah.
But I'm curious how the training would kick in if it was a loved one who'd been fatally shot in some sort of random attack or whatever. And I don't wish this upon anyone, of course, clearly, but I'm just curious about looking after your own yourself in your own bubble is one thing, but then how do you transfer that into a situation where you don't have the control? You're not able to positively impact that scenario. But you're the bystander in essence.
And this is a context that I have considered and discussed at different levels. I always say the people watching on suffer more than the person who's in it, because they feel as if they have no control, they have no influence. They can talk to you, they can encourage you, but unless the person themselves actively engages in taking action, nothing is going to improve. And so if I was looking on, there would be this sense of helplessness, absolute positivity, absolutely encouragement. And I laugh because I know that sometimes I've been in these situations where I'm supporting people and my positivity of trying to encourage them to keep on going just becomes a little bit overwhelming for them.
Right. Okay.
I'm that person who is that little bit too positive. So I've now become cognizant of keeping that balance of positivity and encouraging, but also accepting that damn is a challenge.
Yes.
It's sometimes hard to keep on pushing yourself. And it's really hard for people supporting to keep that balance because they can maybe see potential. But they also are sometimes worried, like doctors were predicting, I may never walk properly again. You may spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair with those injuries. You'll never go back to work. Just, you know, enjoy your pension. All those sorts of predictions because that's how they perceive it.
Yeah.
I hope that I never offer those sorts of support. But there's some reality in there as well. So
yeah, and the reason I asked that question is really candidly, I think it must have been absolutely very difficult for your family. That would have been just a nightmare scenario for them, no matter how many conversations that you have.
Correct.
When that scenario becomes a reality, it would be devastating. And so I really feel for your family on that. I think that would have been very, very tough on them. I wanted to ask you a little bit about durability versus resilience. And I know we've been talking about durability in and around it, but just from a definition point of view, just because I think resilience is a word that it's a really important topic, of course, and I don't want to diminish it, but that they are different, aren't they, resilience and durability?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you really analyze the word resilience, there is durability built into it. But what I talk about is the general concept that people have is that resilience is the ability to encounter a problem, go through a problem-solving process, find a solution and bounce back and fix the problem and then continue on. But that implies that you're going to have a peak of performance, then you're going to have a massive drop, and then you've got to grow again to another peak, then you're going to have another massive drop. And you're right, resilience is a strength that we have to embrace. We always have to embrace that. It's very powerful. If you can get to a place where you go, do you know something, no matter what happens, I'll be able to solve that problem and we will be able to move on. It is a strength and we've got to embrace that. A situation that I like to refer to is the explosion in the port of Beirut back in 2020.
Yeah.
Massive explosion, 3,000 rounds of chemicals, 350-odd people killed, you know, thousands injured, massive devastation. Lebanese government and the media were saying, Lebanese people are resilient. We've had invasions, political collapse, financial collapse. We've got refugee overwhelm now. Lebanese people are resilient. They will be able to bounce back. There was a lady that I heard interviewed by the ABC, and she said, I'm tired of being resilient. I just want to be able to enjoy my life.
Mm.
And I think that's the point we all get to. Resilience is absolutely invaluable. Never get past the fact that that is invaluable. But we also want to get to the point where we are able to perform at a 100% reliable. We know exactly what's going to happen. And we can relax in that environment.
Mm.
And some people have trouble getting their head around the concept that you could be 100% reliable. Everything that you want to do is going to go absolutely perfectly. And the easiest analogy outside of business, and this applies to business in every part of life, the easiest analogy is a sporting analogy. If you start tennis at D grade and you become a beginner and you're kind of fragile, you're making mistakes, you become resilient, you can problem solve, you then become the best of the best in D grade, what happens is you go up into C grade, you're now no longer the best of the best, you're sort of middle of the pack, you're resilient again. But if you're keen and eager and you go on and you get coaching and all the rest of it, you become the best of the best in C grade, you go up to B grade. And again, the process happens, you go up to A grade. Then there may be some other impacts. There may be family issues, there may be work comes into it and you don't have the time to train. When you come down from A grade back to B grade, it's pretty easy. But if you have to come back to C grade, there is no challenge here.
Mm.
You can go out without training because your skills are so much greater than everybody around you that you can just perform 100% reliably, win every game. That context happens within our careers, within our relationships, within our life. If you think about you were a dentist, the first day that you came out of dentist school, obviously university, and went into practice, there was this overwhelming, oh, my God, what am I doing? Mm-hmm. Am I going to be all right? Can you give me some coaching here? Will you watch me? But now you became practice manager and you're 100% reliable. Now you're taking on another level of challenge in that you're starting to coach people in managing their own practice.
Mm.
If you had to go back to managing your own practice, it'd be like, oh, okay, I'm going to get bored doing this because there is no challenge. And that happens in every aspect of our lives. But generally speaking, we're working in this area between resilience and durability. right, where we're pretty good at what we do, but we still have some learning to do. And as soon as we get really good at what we do, we take on another challenge.
Yeah.
But every now and then we need to know exactly where we are 100% reliable. And this is a concept that I love talking about because it's something that people don't always talk about, is that where we're 100% reliable is our comfort zone.
Mm.
This is where we can relax. We know we're good. There is no mental stress within that comfort zone because it is your comfort zone. And people say, you've got to get out of your comfort zone. That's where growth is. And that's very true. But there is always times in life where you need to climb back into the comfort zone and take the pressure off.
Yeah.
And this is where you rest, relax, replenish, re-energize, get your mental health back, get stability back, become comfortable with your life again and go, okay, I'm now ready to take on that challenge. And there are very few people that I've ever heard talking about climb back into the comfort zone, get comfortable, get in control of your mental health, most importantly. So human durability is actually the ability to sustain optimal performance in whatever environment we are. I talk about two models of resilience. One is functional resilience, which is the rest, relax, replenish. And I talk about aspirational resilience, which is the resilience and six specific steps in each of those. But aspirational resilience is what we need to have to be able to continue to push ourselves and to chase those dreams, chase those goals. We know they're going to be hard. We know there's going to be stress, but we're passionate about them. We want to make them happen. Durability comes from being able to avoid the burnout that comes with pushing ourselves continually, because if we stay in aspirational, we'll go into burnout. So we've got to know when is the right time to flick from aspirational back to functional, back into the comfort zone, back to safe harbor where we can rest, relax, replenish, repair, and go back. But if we stay in functional too long, we'll go into rust out because we're not using our minds. We're not pushing ourselves. And so it's flicking back in there.
Sure.
But human durability is how do we sustain optimal performance? It's not peaks and troughs. It's how do we sustain that continuous growth, anticipating what the problems might be and having solutions in mind before they even happen. The same as I built up my processes before I got shot. The reality is it may happen, and if it does happen, how do I sustain optimal performance in that environment? And so that's my concept of human durability.
It does sound a lot like pre-planning and pre-thinking about all manner of situations has a lot to do with embracing durability. So I guess for those people listening to the podcast, if we wanted to give them some strategies or some ideas about how to improve or increase their durability, pre-planning would be one of them. Are there any other things that you'd add to that list?
Yeah, absolutely. It's about embracing the concept that you've got to be pre-planning, but you've also got to be able to anticipate what you're going to do in the midst of the situation and then what it's going to look like afterwards. And this is all part of your pre-planning, because when we can look at what it's going to be like afterwards, I may spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. Anything better than death is a bonus. If my business collapses, what's that going to look like for the family? In fact, I had a conversation with the people from Silly International Air Conditioning, Kathy and Frank, beautiful, beautiful people. And Frank had a conversation with Kathy, and this is a reflection Kathy had with me after I'd run one of my workshops for, they forced me to go to Fiji with them. So that was
tough,
terrible.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I ran a workshop for them there, and Kathy had a reflection with me that Frank sat down with her and said, I want to do this with the business. Now, if we're successful, it's going to look great. But if it fails, we're going to be living in a tin shed at the back of a block. We're not going to have any money. And Kathy was able to say to Frank, do you know something, Frank? So long as I have you in my life, I'm going to be happy no matter what we're going to be doing.
Mm.
That gave Frank the confidence to go and push, knowing that if he failed, the relationship is still going to be good. Not many people have those conversations in the relationship. They say it might be difficult, but not to that depth. Some people do, and don't get me wrong, some people absolutely do it well. Some people just continually, completely avoid that conversation because it's too challenging, it's too confronting, it's too scary. They just want to look at the shiny things. So that's an important place to go to, that pre-planning. Accepting responsibility on four levels, you will be doing that planning, understanding that cognitively, what you're going to be doing. And it's about risk tolerance. Where does your risk tolerance sit? Can I live with that risk? And if you get to the point where you go, you know, something that would destroy my relationship, that would destroy my financial future, that would destroy my enjoyment of life, we need to be confident enough, and this comes out of a couple of models that I work with, where we are comfortable that I've addressed the challenge. Yes, it would be huge, but we've got the resources, finance, support, infrastructure, whatever it might be, and you get that level of comfort. Even if that happens, we'll survive. Okay, let's go forward confidently, courageously. The other side is that we're able to go, do you know, if that happens, it will destroy us. We don't have the resources. We don't have the expertise. But you can now step back and say, I am comfortable that I'm not going to do it, and articulate the reasons why. And as leaders, we need to be able to articulate those reasons rather than just going, it doesn't feel right, I'm not sure, because that doesn't instill confidence in those people who are around us and following us. When we can articulate the reasons, they will respect us and go, do you know something? I don't always agree with what the person is saying. I caught myself in saying him there, what the person is saying, but I can see that they're going through a thinking process. But it also sets us up to, we can have a conversation about what's lacking. We can have a conversation about that risk rather than, oh, it just doesn't feel right. There is no conversation around that.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Derek, just to shift gear for a second, in researching prior to our conversation today, I noticed that the perpetrator from those events in 1994, the siege, Tony Grosser, he spent a lot of time in prison and has since been released. And I wanted to talk about forgiveness and the topic of forgiveness. And I wondered how you feel about the perpetrator and, in fact, his release from prison.
It's a really interesting question, and it causes a lot of dilemma for a lot of people. And some people embrace what I'm about to tell you now. Some people, it still confuses them. Forgiveness is only something you can give to someone who accepts responsibility and they are compassionate about the harm they have caused. And the offender in this case is not. Throughout the court case, he said, yes, I shot the rifle, but I shot it near Derek. I didn't actually hit him. Maybe it was my wife. She opened another door when he went around the corner and maybe she shot him. Or Derek's mates at work hated him, and so they put him up against a wall and shot him five times with a shotgun. And so he's always tried to deflect responsibility and never accepted responsibility of, he's the person who shot me. There is no doubt about it. So I can't forgive him. On the same token, I don't feel a need to, right? This goes back to taking responsibility on four levels. Lots of people say when bad things happen, who's responsible? And I love asking this question in my workshops. And I say, who's responsible for me getting shot? And people go, the guy with the gun that pulled the trigger. Oh, yeah, that's excellent. And I say, excellent, let's blame him. Who else can we blame? Oh, you can blame your boss for making that decision. You blame your mates for not supporting you, blah, blah, blah. Right down to, you can blame the manufacturers of the weapons and the bullets, and we can blame lots and lots of people, and then people start saying, well, actually, you're responsible. And you can see I'm a little bit lighthearted, and my response is, me? I didn't do anything wrong. I am not responsible for this. I didn't do anything wrong. And so I'm not even talking to you anymore, and I talk to other people, but I obviously come back to that person. And we don't need to take responsibility for the whole thing, right? I didn't point the gun at myself. I didn't pull the trigger. But my part, I made a choice to go into the police department. I made a choice to go into Star Group. I made a choice to go on that job. Even though I was tasked to go on that job, I had a responsibility to say yes or no. I made a choice to go down the side of the house. I put myself in a situation where I knew that this was a risk and a real possibility, and I need to take responsibility for my part. When we start saying, I'm not responsible, it's not my fault, somebody else's, we are never going to fix that problem for ourselves. So I don't need to give him forgiveness. I need to understand my part in all of that. And the next question on from forgiveness is generally, do you have any want of revenge? And I'm very comfortable to say I have no want of revenge. I'm responsible for going in there. Fortunately, he didn't target Derek. He shot the cop.
Yeah.
So it's a slightly removed situation. Yeah, but certainly as we were going through court, it was, you know, you're guilty of shooting Derek. Everything was personal on Derek. But so there's that third party reserved part to it as well. But I don't want revenge. I don't want retribution. If I was focused on revenge, retribution, that's where my energy would have gone. My energy went to my recovery, my family, and those sorts of things which were positives in my life. It was always accepting I didn't like him. I still don't like him.
It's really interesting. I had a conversation with a gentleman on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, Rod Cottam, really nice guy, army fellow. And interestingly, his situation was he was riding to work on a motorbike one day and got cleaned up by a car and had a really nasty injury. You know, he went straight up, straight down, which meant the energy of the fall basically went through his body and he didn't roll across the tarmac or the bitumen and have that energy dissipated. The long and short of it is he has been left with a left arm that doesn't work the way it used to. And he is one of the nicest guys, smart guy, but he made some comments very eerily, very similar to you, which were, I take responsibility for my part in that accident. Yes, that person ran a red light. Yes, that person cleaned me up. But I chose to ride a motorbike. I knew the risks of riding a motorbike before I got on the motorbike and so on and so forth. So I wanted to ask this question as a follow-up for this because this seems to be a recurring theme recently, and that is the taking of responsibility doesn't seem, in my view or in my experience, it doesn't seem to be a particularly popular theme these days. And I wanted to get your take on that if we could.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. The theme these days is avoiding taking responsibility and avoiding being told off. What I'm seeing in corporate world and sometimes in families is that if something goes wrong, other people are looking to point the finger and say, it was your fault, right? Not my fault, it's your fault, so I'm okay and I'll still be able to get my promotions. I'll be able to take accolades for what I've done well, but I can deflect here, I can deflect there. And the conversation I have with, you know, executives is, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could empower your workforce to go, hey, I've made a mistake, and you say, brilliant, excellent, let's you've identified it, now let's get proactive and fix it, rather than let it compound by time and situations, and one bad decision will lead to another bad decision to try and cover it up, then another bad decision to try and cover that up, and that compounding effect. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you had a workforce who have gone, do you know something, I stuffed up, I've made a mistake, I broke this, I didn't have a good interaction with that client, I was having a bad day, XYZ. And everybody goes, oh, that'd be great. My question is, do you lead that way?
Yeah.
And again, I reflect back to raising my own children. There would be a glass drop in the kitchen and it would break. And visiting children would go, oh, my God, you know, what's going to happen now? And my kids are going, oh, Dad will come in and help us clean it up, because that was my approach to it. They didn't maliciously throw the glass on the ground. They made a mistake, and, you know, let's address it. And sure, we don't want to repeat. Now we're going to talk about positive consequence, negative consequence. It's a negative consequence. We don't want to repeat that. But what I also did with my children is have a conversation with them. And this is what executives, managers, leaders don't do, is sit down with people and say, wow, you made some great decisions. You had some great actions. You had a really good consequence. Let's analyze that. How do we repeat the good stuff as much as we avoid doing the bad stuff again? But when we can repeat the good stuff, we can create successes. But we don't sit down and actually talk about the process we went through to get the positive results.
Derek, I'm very mindful. We've been talking for a while and you've been exceedingly generous with your time. And I could, as we said, five episodes. I think we've got enough material there to keep going for days and days and days, mate.
Yeah,
but I want to firstly say thank you so much for sharing not just your experiences and your insights, because as difficult as that must have been, I think there's so many good things that have obviously come out of that for you, lots of positives.
Yeah.
And not that we'd wish that upon anyone, but, you know, I'm really impressed and grateful for the silver lining that's come out of that for you. And I thank you for sharing it with us today.
Thank you, Jesse.
But I also just want to say thank you for the work you're doing on durability, because I think it's actually really important in today's world. I think we run the risk of becoming fragile. And I think, you know, in a world that is changing rapidly, it's uncertain. Yeah, things are always moving, and I think with the ability to be resilient, the ability to be durable hand in hand with one another is a really important attribute no matter what you do in life. And I just want to say thank you for the work you do.
Jesse, thank you. It's a privilege to be on a show like yours. You obviously have quite a lot of credibility, so thank you for the invite to be with you and to be able to share this. And again, the work I'm doing now goes back to passion. I love to analyze behavior and help people improve on what they're already doing, looking at the good things they're doing and how do we repeat those. And so this is a work I just enjoy. And it is wonderful. I'm able to pass on what I've learned to my children, which is the most important thing to me, but maybe also building up a legacy that's going to last. And this will create a conversation that will go further than me.
It's that whole drop a pebble in a pond and watch the ripples continue on, mate. Yeah. And I think, you know, the ripples turn into waves, and I think you're unleashing a lot of energy there, mate. So thank you once again, and I hope we can connect again soon.
I look forward to it, Jesse. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.